I got a draft notice one day that said you can be drafted into the Army. I was playing professional soccer.
So take me to Vietnam. What was it like when you first stepped off that plane?
Stepping off the plane, it's strange and different because I had been raised in Florida and hadn't traveled a lot around the world. But we stepped off, and immediately, you know, things were different. There wasn't the bright lights that you see in America, all the advertising. Everybody there seemed to be on purpose, on task. It wasn't like anybody had a free or off time. When I arrived there in November, it was a little bit chilly, but we had a lot of rain. It's a tropical zone, and it was nice. You don't think about the weather over there. You don't think about days where there's rain or sunshine. I found out shortly after I get there, you start a calendar to count down the days until you can leave. Everybody did it. A short-timer's calendar is what it's called. It's not so short when you've got 364 days left. I started off as a private, 1st Signal Corps, and I was with the 97th Signal Battalion, stationed in Da Nang, Vietnam. It was in the I Corps, the northernmost region. We were about 25 or 26 miles south of the DMZ, demilitarized zone, and I was 21 years old. It was in the spring of 1969. We had guard towers, and those were always manned in the evenings and daytime. And he says he thought he saw something out in the rice paddy. I looked out there, and I couldn't see anything. He said, well, I'm getting the binoculars. And when he reached for the binoculars, all I remember is just something hit me. I got knocked to the back of the guard tower where I was knocked unconscious. And then I woke up in the hospital. I had been shot. One of those saving graces that I had this Bible that a Haitian missionary had given me when I went to the Methodist church camp. It was one of those small India paper, real thick, but small. And it was stuck in my right pocket, right at my chest. And my flak jacket that I had on had little leather pouches that kept shrapnel or bullets like that from hitting you. But they had seams between them. And this bullet had hit the Bible, and it hit the flak jacket where the lead lining was. So all I ended up with is some broken blood vessels. A few nights after that, I started having these nightmares, like an out-of-body experience where you see yourself being hit. And it's like the bullet really did penetrate you and take out your midsection. I would wake up breathing hard, not able to go back to sleep. Something inside me said I shouldn't have lived through this, but I did, and I was real lucky. I was able to send that home. I wasn't supposed to. Government regulation says you're not supposed to send home any ammunition or anything. But I was real careful and wrapped it up and sent it home to my mom. And she wrote back, and she said she cried when she got it, and she couldn't wait for me to get back home safe.
Vietnam was a very bloody war, whether you call it a conflict or a war. It was a bloody experience. But sometimes those casualties were not always the result of enemy fire.
That's very true.
Talk to me about that.
Well, it was New Year's Eve, and I was just the runner. We had an NCO and an officer in charge of the compound. Because we were a signal compound, it was real fortified around the side. And we had guard towers. And our instructions as it approached New Year's Eve were that nobody was to fire any weapons. We may hear weapons being fired outside our compound somewhere just to note where they were, but there's no weapons to be fired. And that night we were there, and everything had been quiet. And then we hear a gunshot. And the NCO goes one direction, and the officer tells me to go to the other way. Like we took each of us took a half of the compound, find out where it is, tell the person to come back with you. And so I took off going around. I'm looking, and we have these Quonset huts that have sandbags in the side, almost like a small airplane hangar. And it's where you sleep at night, and it's for protection. And so I was going along the Quonset huts after I checked a couple of empty buildings and nothing, and I opened this one Quonset hut. To the horror of just seeing just lots of blood and seeing a body there. And it was horrible. My mind blanked out a lot of what I saw, but I just passed out then. I just wasn't able to handle it, and I woke up in the hospital, and I found out the next day, went back to my unit, and I found out that the person had committed suicide. We found out from the chaplain. He had counted down to 10 days, and he was going to be leaving in 10 days and was so excited because he was going to go home and get married. And he had talked about his fiance the whole time while I had been over there. And he thought he was going to go home and get married to his fiance. And the chaplain shared with us, about five or six of us that worked with the chaplain's office, that his fiance was already married and was pregnant with someone else's child. And she had been keeping up this correspondence with him all this time, with him thinking that he was going home, only to find out 10 days before I get a letter that says, "I'm sorry, I'm married, and I'm going to have someone else's child. Please don't come around and bother us." And so all his dreams were all of a sudden dissipated. All this reason to live through everything that was going on over there was gone. It's rough. You know, many of us in the unit felt, boy, he didn't deserve this. Nobody deserves it. Why couldn't she be honest with him? But everybody's got a life to lead. Unfortunately, he's ended like that.
How old was he?
He was younger than I was. I believe he was like 19 years old.
So what kept you hanging on?
Well, at first I thought that I'd go back. If I made it through that, made it through my first enlistment, I did have thoughts that I might be still in good enough shape that I'd go back and play professional sports again. That was a desire. But to be back home and be alive, because you don't realize till you're in a situation like that, and you see and you hear guns going off, and you hear about bombs, and we had rockets coming in all the time in our compound, kind of trying to take out the communications. I think the whole time we were over there, we were lucky if there was maybe a half a dozen to a dozen nights in which we didn't have rocket attacks on our compound. And it keeps you awake. You wake up. Even if you're not working that night, you can't go back to sleep, so you sit around and play some cards just to get yourself back in the mood, so see if you can get 30 minutes sleep before you're going to be up and go to work again. And everybody was like that.
What helped you get through every day? What motivated you or encouraged you to hope?
The desire to go back home and see brothers and sisters and mom again. See friends. And you felt a sense of responsibility. We felt that we were there for a purpose and we're supporting our government.
You did have some happy times.
There were. You needed that. You needed the happy times to get you through. Some of the guys in our unit got involved in an orphanage near the beach in Da Nang. And we would go out there maybe once a week, sometimes once in a while, maybe twice a week, and spend maybe two or three hours, sometimes as many as 4 hours. I can remember the time that we had all the extra paint, and we painted some of the classrooms and some of the desks. They had these really old-fashioned desks, and it needed paint so bad. And we just grabbed whatever paint was left over from whatever cause, and we just started painting, mixed it all together, and it came out to some type of a color, a brownish color. And the kids came around, and it was fun. When I noticed one time, there was a little boy standing off to a distance, and he was about 4 years old, and he wasn't with the other kids and cheering and laughing and talking with us. And so I went over to speak to him, and I was trying to talk to him, and I didn't realize that he was blind. And the chaplain came over and pointed to his eyes and shook his head, let me know that he was blind. And so I reached down, and he hugged me. Wow, you know, it felt great. There was a lot in that hug. said, you know, special hug. So I got kind of attached. So every time I'd go back to the orphanage, you know, all the little boys come up every time you come because you took little candy and took little things to for them too, some sea ration desserts and things like that, or desserts you'd get from the mess hall. This one little boy just always hung close to me, and I'd look for him special, and we developed kind of a bond. And then it came time for me to leave. And I know when I got down about 6 weeks, I asked Chaplin any way I could take him back with me. That his parents were killed when he was truly a baby, an infant, and he was blinded by the flash of a rocket from the enemy. And it just felt so not right coming home and leaving him there. No one to defend him. No more hugs. Army regulations say there's absolutely no way I could bring him back. This little boy, he'd be about 40 now.